when me and Ali got together to discuss what we would like to do with this meeting, this was what came to us about the importance of telling the coming generation. And in lots of ways, we've had quite a momentous week this week. And for most of you, you will have been afforded the opportunity to contribute to the decision-making that's taken place because of the democratic rights we have in this country. And for some of us, it may have been some triumph if we fell on the side of what was the majority. And for others, of us, it will have been the worst news we could have woken up to on Friday morning because we felt the loss of something we wanted to keep. I'm not a politician, and I'm not an economist or a global trader, and I'm certainly not here this morning to commentate on what's happened in world politics this week. But I have been an observer of the discourse that's arisen as a result of the referendum. And when preparing for this morning this week, I felt I've had a very heavy heart because of what's characterizing that discourse. The internet has made our loudest voices possible. Anything we want to share with the world is possible. It's made our truths possible. It's made our opinions possible. It's made our views and ideas, judgments, biases, thoughts, everything possible. And there's some great power in that. Because of the internet, I have read these past few weeks about the brave fight of a young girl exposing the hard truths about being a victim of assault. I've read about the sincere battle of an adoptive mother and her journey to finally building her own family. I've read about the father and husband who lost his wife and the mother of his children to cancer when she was in her early 40s. The global phenomenon of the internet, of worldwide broadcasting, radio, all of these great means we have made it possible for us to shout whatever we want to a world ready to listen. And on a personal note, I can follow the teachings of my favorite writers, John Piper, Timothy Keller, David Platt, Kirsten Welch. I can enrich my spiritual life at the click of a button. We have more means of telling the next generation whatever we want them to hear. And that is both amazing and terrifying. Just over a week ago, I had a job interview, and I spent a good deal of time preparing for that interview. I did plenty of research, read extensively, talked to people who had expertise, and practiced answering questions that might be asked. And in amongst all of that, I found myself the 3 days before the interview on a course in Stirling speaking to some fellow professionals, and I told them of my kind of forthcoming interview. And one of them said to me, because I was asking for advice, if you've got anything that you can offer me, I'll gratefully receive it. And one of them said, after asking a few questions about the job I was applying for, "What's your trump card?" I felt a bit blank at first, my trump card. And then he asked again, "What's your trump card? What do you have in your hand that others might not?" And these same words have kept coming back to me over the course of this week, and particularly in these last few days. When we face adversity, despair, regret, upset, what is our trump card? When we face the outcome of a referendum decision that we may not have personally voted for, what is our trump card? When the world is watching us, when our children and young people are watching us, when we choose to expose our views through the discourse channels we have at our fingertips, what is our trump card? What this morning, in the wake of major political upheaval, global turmoil on so many levels, is our trump card? When we look at our young people, our children, grandchildren, what is our trump card? Do we even behave as though we have one? The theme of this morning is tell the coming generation. So I have two questions for us this morning. One, who are we talking about when we talk about a coming generation? And what are we telling them? So if I were to ask you, who is the coming generation? Who does your mind instantly spring to? Your children, your grandchildren, the youth you work with or teach, your nephews and nieces, the kids in your neighborhood, any or all of those? To some extent, we all come into contact with young people who are the coming generation. Whether or not we have children, whether or not we have grandchildren, whether or not we are immersed in youth work, if you're even here this morning, you've been rubbing shoulders with our young people this morning. You've definitely heard them. They've sang to you. Some of them you may know personally. Some of them you may not. Some of them you may be related to. Some of them you may not. But if we have young people in our midst, how blessed are we? If there was no one in this church, say, under the age of 25, what kind of church would we be? What would Lerwick Baptist Church look like in 50 years' time if that fact remained so? Would it even exist? I maybe don't have to persuade you too much that the next generation is important. It might even seem like I'm asking ridiculous questions. But the reality is that unless we recognize who the next generation are and know them, and I mean really know them, then we're in danger of losing them altogether. Studies show that 70% of young adults with an evangelical background drop out of church, and only 35% of them ever return. So what do I mean by know them? How can we know the young people we find ourselves around, whether they're in our homes, neighborhoods, church buildings, or youth groups? Let me read some information to you that I found out. These are the main problems facing young people today. Some of this won't be new to you, and some of these problems you may well recognize in your own life from when you were young. But here we go. Here are the major problems facing our young people today. Family breakdown. Pressure to have access to money, the perfect body, and lifestyle. Materialism. 24-hour social networking and what young people can access from a young age. Body image. Bullying on and offline. Increasing sexual pressures and early sexualization. Schools getting more and more like exam factories. When we look at our coming generation, what do we see? Kids as they've always been. Sure, there's a bit of that. There'll always be a bit of that. But our young people have more pressures than we could ever imagine. And how many of those problems I mentioned are completely countercultural when it comes to a Christian worldview? Friends, we have a job to do here. We have our work cut out for us because some of this stuff's hard to think about even as an adult, let alone carry the burden of as a child. We cannot, simply cannot, take it for granted that our churched children will be protected from any of this, that it will not infiltrate their lives or spoil their youth. Did you know that one of the four most important factors in determining which teenagers stayed in church was to do with the fact that a significant spiritual and personal investment was made into them by a member of their church? That means that if there are four ways we can influence our young people, one of those is to get alongside them, disciple them, and input into their spiritual growth. Now, don't get me wrong. Among those four factors, the role of parent was one, and you would be absolutely right to come back to me and remind me that Christian parents have the bulk of responsibility when it comes to raising a child. By no means am I suggesting that either myself or others among us with kids can abdicate our responsibility in raising our children in the Lord. But I'm urging you to help in whatever way you can. And I'm saying this as a parent in the middle of generations. We do our best to instruct our children, bring them up in the Lord. We do not always do this well. Our human frailty often works against us, and we cannot claim to have made every decision perfectly. But by the grace of God, we get up and go again. But the parents you see around you are in uncharted waters. We are navigating our way through storms our parents and grandparents never imagined possible. We are trying to decide how much screen time is too much time. What age is the right age to get a mobile phone? How to make sure our children do not see disturbing images or play age-inappropriate games at friends' houses? How to lock our internet to the hilt because our kids are two clicks away from a pornographic image? The coming generation has much to bear, and the generation who birthed them needs much support. We need your patience and prayer, your understanding and care, your wisdom and your grace. Which brings me to my second question about what we're telling each successive Grant generation. Children fortunate enough to belong to Christian homes and attend a weekly Sunday school should at least be exposed to biblical truths and stories. My observance as both a parent and a Sunday school teacher is that most children's books hinge around stories of the Old Testament, such as Jonah and Moses, and that stories of Jesus, such as calming the storm and feeding the masses. The psalm we've read this morning encourages us to make sure that we know what the Lord has done. Psalm 78, verse 4, "We will tell the next generation the praiseworthy deeds of the Lord, his power, and the wonders he has done." And where best to get this than the Bible? I'm going to read you a selection of extracts from the Jesus Storybook Bible. This is one of my personal favorites when it comes to communicating the word to children. God wrote, "I love you." He wrote it in the sky and the earth and under the sea. He wrote his message everywhere. Because God created everything in his world to reflect him like a mirror, to show us what he's like, to help us to know him, to make our hearts sing. Now, some people think the Bible is a book of rules telling you what you should and shouldn't do. The Bible certainly does have some rules in it. They show you how life works best. But the Bible isn't mainly about you and what you should be doing. It's about God and what he has done. It takes the whole Bible to tell this story. God looked at everything he had made. Perfect, he said. And it was. But all the stars and mountains and oceans and galaxies were nothing compared to how much God loved his children. Whatever happened, whatever it cost him, he would always love them. And from this, we read book after book that proves over and over again God's love for his people, his patience, his mercy, his grace, and his compassion. We learn what makes him angry and disappointed. We learn about redemption and hope and Jesus. All of this is good, good stuff. If we are feeding our children scripture, then we are feeding them biblical truth. And I've learned that there is a paper plate craft for pretty much any Bible story you ever come across. We must never, ever give up on telling our children and young people the stories and wisdoms from the scriptures. But I want to challenge us this morning to dig even further. John Piper warns us of this: dry, unemotional, indifferent teaching about God, whether at home or at church, is a half-truth at best. It says one thing about God and portrays another thing. It is inconsistent. It says that God is great, but teaches as if God is not great. And then he goes on to say of Psalm 71:18, which reads, "Even to old age and gray hairs, O God, do not forsake me until I proclaim your might to another generation, your power to all those to come." I am called to proclaim the might of God, the power of God, the majesty of God, the sovereignty of God to another generation. The study that I cited earlier tells us about the reasons why teenagers drop out of church. Our surveys show a lack of intentionality in dropping out. 80% of young people who dropped out of church said they did not plan to do so during school. It's not that most rejected the church. Our teenagers aren't primarily leaving because they have significant disagreements with their theological upbringing or out of some sense of rebellion. For the most part, they simply lose track of the church and stop seeing it as important to their life. Let that just resonate with you for a moment. It stops being important to their life. If we want to reach out and tell a coming generation about the Lord, if we want to be role models, leaders, teachers, I'm convinced that we have to make sure that we are consistently and persistently showing them our trump card. God is on the throne and Jesus has the victory. In every storm and challenge of life, God is on the throne and Jesus has the victory. When life's pressures are too much, God is on the throne and Jesus has the victory. Amid cyberbullying, sexual pressure, materialism, family breakdown, God is on the throne and Jesus has the victory. And none of this means that we sweep all our problems under the carpet, adopt for ourselves this as a mantra, and carry on as though nothing's happened. None of this means we do not lament and mourn and weep, that we do not express regret or sadness, that we do not feel heartbreak or loss. Romans 12:15 exhorts us to rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. The feelings we have can be of great benefit to us, so long as we do not let them define us, so long as we do not trust them or believe they have our best interests at heart. Jeremiah 17:9 says, "The heart is more deceitful than all else and is desperately sick." How many emotional decisions have you ever made that were regrettable or not a great idea? If you're anything like me, you can probably run that number into the thousands. I cannot trust my heart. It is flesh, and it fails me every day. And this is why we need Jesus. Mark 2:17 tells us that Jesus himself said that this is why he came. It is not the healthy who need a doctor, it's the sick. Recently, after a bout of less than stellar behavior, my son came to me and said he was afraid he was going to hell. When I asked him why, he said it was because of his mistake, that he makes mistakes often and sometimes can't seem to help it all too well. What a privilege have I to be able to whisper back to him, "Son, so do I. This is why we need Jesus. I make mistakes too. But this is the very best part. We read in Romans 10, if you declare with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. We are not here to present to the coming generation a set of production line, we've got it sussed Christians. We are not here to try and make out that among all of life's trials and troubles, we have a stiff upper lip and we march on devoid of emotion. How much more powerful are we when we can say, I struggled with that too, but I have a trump card. My faith in Jesus means I believe that God is king and sin is conquered and death is defeated. I'm scared of that too, but I have a trump card. God knew this would happen long before I ever did, and he is still king. I have felt that disappointment too. But I know that whatever happens, Jesus will never let me down. He will never forsake me or leave me. Our testimonies are powerful. And that is why we read in Psalm 78, verse 4, tell to the coming generation the glorious deeds of the Lord and his might and the wonders he has done. We teach Bible truth. We show them characters and tell them stories. And we tell them what God has done for us. What has God done in your life? What is he doing yesterday, today? How are you telling of the wondrous works and mighty deeds he has done for you? We can look to the scriptures for God's character and faithfulness, and we can look to our own lives for echoes of the same. Some of us may feel the quake of uncertainty in the days to come. We may experience unimaginable loss and heart-searing pain. But let our discourse be seasoned with salt and love, grace and mercy. Let our actions be driven not by the motives of secular government, but out of our love for the Lord and his people. Let our testimony be that whatever the future holds, we know the one whose hands hold it fast. Our coming generation needs to see that Jesus lives in us, that he is real, that he is alive, that he loves us deeply and cares for us, that nothing on this earth can compare to the glory that awaits those who love and serve him. I urge you today, whatever generation you are from, whatever your marital status, parental status, grandparental status, or involvement in youth work, I urge you to take up the baton in whatever way you can. Our young Sunday school will be back here in a few minutes to show you the work they've just been doing. Take a good look at their faces. Learn and remember their names. Love, care for, serve, protect, nurture, listen to, and above all, pray for our next generation, it's time we all started showing what a really great hand we've got.